call our first case, I will, of course, remind you all and remind us that today is the sixth month anniversary of September 11th, 2001, which is a day we will all remember not only for the attack on human life in the country, but an attack on the rule of law to which all of us are committed. And your being here today and our hearing cases is a part of our democratic constitutional system of due process for all people. This is 002636W, State Ex Rel Gerald Haas versus McReynolds. We'll first hear from attorney Robert G. Bernhoft, who represents Mr. Haas.
Good morning. May it please the court. Attorney Robert Bernhoft, representing Gerard Haas, Jr., his challenge to the municipal, the Court of Appeals' refusal to issue a writ of habeas corpus on a petition that was originally certified to the Court of Appeals by this court. Before we turn to argument, I wanted to briefly thank the court staff, and opposing counsel for accommodating our scheduling conflict with an argument before the Seventh Circuit. We appreciate that. Our argument before the court this morning is twofold. First, the Court of Appeals wrongly concluded that habeas corpus did not lie for Haas because he was not in actual physical custody at the time he sued out his writ. And second, the doctrine that habeas corpus will not lie where an alternative remedy exists also did not bar that successive petition, again contrary to the Court of Appeals holding. As to the first argument regarding actual physical custody, as we pointed out in our main brief, Wisconsin follows the constructive custody rule in force and effect in so many other state jurisdictions and in the federal court system. It's a rule dating from antiquity, a rule discussed by the United States Supreme Court in Jones v. Cunningham, where they surveyed the English and American jurisprudential history. And of course, the Court of Appeals of this state in Wolfart v. Baudette cited to Jones v. Cunningham and articulated the constructive custody rule for the state of Wisconsin. It also follows, the constructive custody rule follows from the general notion that habeas corpus should be construed liberally in favor of the citizen's liberty. So it's in conformity with larger principles of sound judicial policy and public policy as well.
Counsel, when Mr. Bernhoft, if I might ask you, you talked about the Wolfart case, and you've indicated that there was a constructive custody situation here. Now, I've looked at the orders that were issued by Judge Torhorst, and the first order, which is dated the 11th of February, basically indicates that Mr. Haas is set at his liberty until he voluntarily appears at a return hearing. There's no requirement for a personal recognizance bond. There's no requirement for any bail. There's no conditions in regard to his release. And in the Wolfert case, there was a personal recognizance bond. There were a number of conditions on the face of the bond in regard to the release. How can the Wolfert case be precedent for what you're arguing here today? It appears to me, at least, be a totally different situation.
Justice Crooks, your point is well taken. Wolfart stands for the general proposition, although there's some factual distinctions between Wolfart and the case at bar. Wolfart stands for the general proposition that habeas corpus will also lie to one subject to restraints not shared by the public at large. We urge that Haas's release from the Racine County Common Jail was conditional. He was subject to the further process of the trial court, could be called before the trial court by any process the trial court judge sought to use. And in fact, if he did not appear at the appointed time with the voluntary surrender at that date certain that's indicated in the order, a warrant for his arrest would have been issued. We would also point out that a persuasive case from the federal court sitting in the Eastern District of Wisconsin, which we pointed out in our brief, Burby v. Burke, talks about how even absolute discharge from custody will not moot an otherwise proper habeas corpus petition. But back to the facts of the custody, we believe that Haas was certainly under restraints not shared by the public at large, being subject to a recommitment order, being subject to the process of the court, having to file a stay of execution in that event with the trial court and perhaps the Court of Appeals. We believe that that conditional discharge was well within the reach of the constructive custody rule.
Well, even if you go to the order that Judge Torhorst issued in June, you got, in my opinion at least, a very similar situation. In June, basically, he found that the petition for writ of habeas corpus was frivolous. He found that the municipal court had jurisdiction. But then he gave your client the opportunity to appeal, released him again without any recognizance, without any bail, without any conditions, and basically stayed the execution of his order. So again, I'm having trouble with how that amounts to constructive custody, given the fact there's no bond whatsoever, no bail being posted, and no conditions.
Being subject to the further process of the court, in our view, constitutes an essential fact of constructive custody. We would point out in the alternative that even if the court is concerned about the constructive custody issue, this court does, really what that presents is a sort of a mootness question, I suppose. And this court takes up moot questions when serious or important issues are raised or when constitutional challenges are made.
Well, what's the serious or important issue here?
Well, what you have here is Haas challenged both the legality and the constitutionality of commonly used municipal court arrest process.
Was either one of these briefed?
I'm sorry?
Were these issues briefed?
At the trial court level, yes, they were.
Here?
Yes, the merits of the case was not briefed. What we have from the court is the procedural issue of whether the Court of Appeals should have issued the writ and conducted a habeas corpus proceeding. The merits were not briefed before this court. Now, Petitioner Haas did file a pro se petition for an original action habeas corpus petition, and in an accompanying memorandum that was attached to that petition, which is a bit unusual, the merits of his argument that the municipal court lacked jurisdiction to arrest him was briefed. I'm sorry, so that may be what the Chief Justice is referring to. But as to the arrest process, it's an extraordinarily significant question, we believe. We've reviewed and carefully read Haas's submissions with respect to citations, whether that constitutes compulsory process, whether or not it's unconstitutional, violative of the 16th section, Article 1, to imprison for debt, the issue that forfeiture is in the nature of contract.
I think the difficulty, at least when it's words in the Chief's mouth, but I think the problem is that knowing that this matter, the very matter you're talking about, you're saying that was not briefed to this court. That's correct. And normally we do not take answer questions that they would not be briefed by either side.
Mm-hmm.
And that's generally what we would do. And you're saying, well, it was briefed at trial court level, and then we rely on what, that particular brief?
Well taken, Justice Wilcox. To the extent that Haas did file a petition for habeas corpus with this court as an original matter after he was denied ultimate discharge by the Racine County Trial Court, the court did have the full documents, and those documents are contained in petitioner's separate appendix. Now, they weren't briefed, and I was assuming that the Chief Justice asked the question regarding, you know, what's the significant issue here? And so we would simply advert that we've got a commonly used municipal court arrest process, and that's what it is, what's that issue.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that? What's that issue? I didn't hear you.
I'm sorry?
Who am I? Well, I didn't hear you. What's that issue?
We have a commonly used municipal court arrest process.
Common what?
Commonly used.
Commonly used.
Yeah, contempt commitments. and these contempt commitments issue, apparently, to coerce, if you, to use that word, payment of forfeitures, where a person issued a citation refuses to pay the forfeiture by default or otherwise. So that's the significant question. We would also point to the court's jurisprudence with respect to capable of repetition yet evading review. This is an issue that will replicate itself. In fact, Haas was arrested most recently, just this past February, on identical contempt commitment process. So it's an ongoing issue. The issue is before the court.
But why shouldn't we wait until that issue comes up before us? Because that is, I mean, if it hasn't been briefed, it obviously would be briefed this time around.
It would, and of course, we believe that that one of the fundamental issues at stake here is this successive writ doctrine, where a petitioner makes allegations of complete jurisdictional incompetence, and those allegations are at least colorable. The law of Wisconsin is fairly clear. The legislature has never abolished the successive writ. The mere fact that the legislature has made available direct appeal did not abolish, by implication, a common law right that's existed for hundreds of years. And here, Haas was entitled to pursue that successive writ in a superior court, a court superior in a hierarchical sense from the trial court in Racine. And there are several reasons, legal, strategic, and practical, why Haas would want to pursue that successive writ. First, again, as to the law of Wisconsin, it's firmly established that the successive writ lies here. Of course, the court of last resort could alter or modify that, perhaps. We would urge that that might be a suspension of the writ. But
I don't want to be conclusory with this, but it seems to me that when we look at the cases, Fuentes case, the Wolpert case, the various cases that you can convince me otherwise, obviously, that there's been no restraint of your client's liberty other than your constructive viewpoint. And the other thing is that there was no appeal here of the first, you know, the first adverse hearing, and now we're looking at successive writs, and it doesn't seem to meet the criteria set forth in the various cases which the justices have cited and you have cited to this court.
As to the constructive custody issue, when a man is jailed and argues that that custody is unlawful, exceeding jurisdiction, violating the Wisconsin Constitution, and then he is subject to the continuing process of the trial court to command his appearance, to give an account of himself, his whereabouts. He's subject to additional commitment process. We feel that falls squarely within the constructive custody rule as articulated in Jones v. Cunningham, federal case law, and state case law. While Wolfart, as Justice Crooks pointed out, is distinguishable on some facts, the general principle that habeas corpus will reach this sort of custody is part of the law of the state. And I would point out something here as well, and this goes to the question of capable of repetition yet evading review. This is a dilemma for a petitioner who finds himself incarcerated on process he believes is illegal and unconstitutional. And so he's put to the choice. Does he do the 91 days at hard labor in the Racine County Common Jail? Does he pay the money, the $3,100 in forfeitures, to gain his release? And does the mere fact that he's put to this untenable choice and has to pay this money to gain his liberty, and suddenly we say, well, now he's really not within constructive custody. He's not in custody anymore, and so habeas corpus won't lie. We urge that that would be an anomalous finding. A petitioner shouldn't be put to that choice, to pay the money such that he can go about his business and tend to his small business, or to sit in jail to maintain the cause of action. And I suppose he could have done that. He could have done his hard labor in the Racine County Common Jail for 91 days and maintained the cause of action. But that seems to be a mere formalism.
Mr. Bernhoff, let me, if I might, follow up on something that you answered a few minutes ago, I believe, to Justice Wilcox. From the information that was presented to us, we understand that in March of 2000, there were some other processes that were utilized by the municipal court. In other words, as I understand it, there was a summons and a complaint. There were some documents issued that indicated there were 30 violations of city ordinances, apparently all relating to the failure to abate lead paint. And there was a forfeiture, apparently, of some $76,000, or 60 days in jail for each unpaid violation. I understand there were 30. What's happened with that case? Is that case working its way through the court system, or where is it at this point?
I was not retained as counsel on that case, but the status of that case is that that was the subject matter upon which Haas was arrested this past February. And he did pay, I believe, about $2,500 in forfeitures to avoid the jail term. And again, this directly bears on the constructive custody issue in our view. You've got a situation where the issues before the court, at least in a procedural matter, this court's decision, if the court chooses to direct the appellate court to issue the written conduct of proceeding, or perhaps in supervisory capacity to even direct the appellate court to reinstitute the appeal, to get a merits review of the underlying issues and get a final adjudication, we think is very important.
Well, is that other case pending at all, or is it totally settled now because he paid $2,500?
To the extent he paid the forfeitures, that case is closed.
Okay.
Counsel, let me use hypothetically then, since we have a closed case, let me use hypothetically that your client is facing an order that says he's going to be committed for 5 years, for someplace I read near 5 years attended to that, to $76,000 in 5 years.
Yes.
I want to use that hypothetical because sometimes it is the more egregious facts that helps us home in on the issue. Using that hypothetical, what are the alternatives for your client with regard to getting this matter reviewed?
The alternatives to get the underlying allegations of unconstitutional void process as a matter of remedies law might be an action for declaratory relief. Perhaps an affirmative plaintiff's civil rights action. There might be a number of mechanisms by which Haas would be able to cause to be adjudicated the underlying allegations here. We would point out, with respect to municipal court authority, that as the court is well aware, in the late 60s and early 70s, the legislature, with some determination, did remove all criminal jurisdiction from the municipal court. And the idea that the municipal court might arrest for that period of time and impose those sorts of forfeitures is fairly startling.
Well, counsel, if he has available the option to pay, hypothetically, $76,000, then he wouldn't go to jail, right?
That's correct.
He has the option, hypothetically, to go to jail for 5 years, and then he can get out.
Yes.
What if he wants to contest having to pay the $76,000 or go to jail for 5 years?
He could have actually appeared, of course, before the municipal court and retained counsel and appeared and made arguments, if there were any, to answer the complaint and to deal with the issue in a litigation matter. But, of course, we wouldn't be here then now on the fascinating question of municipal court arrest process, but he certainly could have chosen to defend.
And let's say the facts are like we have here, that he brought a writ before the circuit court and it was denied. So let's take the facts procedurally as we have here.
Yes.
But expand the exposure, if you will, to 5 years, $76,000. So he could either pay the $76,000 and literally be home free. he could stay in jail for 5 years. What does he do to get those options reviewed, given this procedural posture? Anything?
I believe he might have an opportunity to file an action for declaratory relief, which would get at the underlying custody. But with respect to his options, if he doesn't appear and defend, and that's the procedural posture we find ourselves in today, then he has this issue of pay the money, do the time, or face commitment process. He's arrested, he's put in jail. He goes to the trial court, files his petition for habeas corpus, it's granted, there's a proceeding, and he's not discharged. And so now he's put to the choice to face, now he's got a strategic decision to make. Does he pursue direct appeal, or does he file a successive writ? And Haas, unlike, I suppose, many citizens, don't really, Haas investigated his rights under the law, and he found that he was entitled to a successive writ. And it's an interesting procedural remedy. For example, it does achieve the speedy and quick review that's the hallmark of habeas corpus. Although the appellate courts, when they entertain extraordinary writs, might not be as quick and speedy as a trial court, yet it is faster than the appellate process.
How much faster?
Months, perhaps. And when you're facing jail or a payment of $76,000, I think that's significant.
There was a stay here. In fact, it's to your client's interest not to have this decided very rapidly. He keeps the money. He's not in jail. Isn't that right?
As a practical matter, once Judge Torhorst issued his stay, but that stay, of course, is only good until the appellate court hears it. I believe Judge Torhorst's stay was not indefinite. There was a date certain at which time Haas would have to demonstrate the fact of the filing of an appeal or a voluntary surrender himself to the court.
The stay is still in effect.
If the stay is still in effect, then Racine County and its officers violated it because they rearrested Haas in the same process in spite of the stay, a point I believe was pointed out in the main brief, a very odd circumstance.
So where is he now?
Mr. Haas is at his liberty, and the issues before the Racine Court will replicate themselves. They will repeat themselves. In fact, we have a situation of ongoing controversy. It's a highly political issue. I can assure you it's the subject of some gravity in the city of Racine and Racine County. And I think it's an important issue. It's before the court, even if the court has difficulty with constructive custody.
What's the political issue?
Well, the politics of the matter is that you've got a municipal court process, a mechanism by which municipal courts regularly enforce the payment of forfeitures where people issued citations don't pay.
And that issue is not before this court now.
No, it is not.
But it was before the circuit court on the habeas petition.
Yes, it was.
And why didn't you pursue your direct appeal of that to get it before an appellate court to get that legal issue resolved in that fashion?
And Mr. Haas was proceeding pro se. He filed, and I've reviewed all of the documents, he filed a notice of appeal. And retrospectively, he told me that he thought he got better review and more efficient, speedy review on successive writs, so he voluntarily withdrew the appeal and pursued the successive writ. And as we point out in some length at the main brief, the successive writ's available to an aggrieved petitioner. And we
only
believe
if there's no adequate other remedy. And what is inadequate about the remedy of direct appeal?
Well, let's take a look at the alternative remedy doctrine and the related no substitution doctrine. They're both related, and this court has talked about these two remedies for 100-some-odd years. And we applied a nomenclature to them. We call them the twin limiting principles, and it's fairly apt. It describes...
Also, I ask a straightforward question.
Yes.
What is inadequate about the remedy of direct appeal?
Yeah, the inadequacy of direct appeal in this case would be time. Habeas corpus is unquestionably quicker. There's also a substantive matter here about habeas corpus review.
How long would a direct appeal have taken in this matter?
12 months to conclusively resolve some such thing. The court might know better than I do with respect to the timing of appeals, but I imagine about 12 months.
And how long has it taken to prosecute this successive writ?
Oh, no question. You know, retrospectively, because
of
the...
A lot longer, right?
Pardon me?
The answer to my question is a lot longer.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. And we can see that retrospectively, of course, has spent a lot more time on the case.
So why shouldn't we view this as just a delaying tactic to avoid the inevitable?
Oh, unquestionably, it was not a dilatory tactic. From my conversations with Haas, he was committed to trying to vindicate the existence of the successive writ. It's sort of admirable, actually, and it presents an intellectual question, gives the court an opportunity to clarify some law. And we believe the application of the twin limiting principles provides a dragnet to separate those cases that allege mere judicial error, constitutional error, from jurisdictional challenge. And the court has deployed these doctrinal tools for 100-some-odd years successfully, but that, of course, didn't diminish the availability of a successive writ. It comes down to entitlement as a matter of law, and we urge that he was entitled to eschew the direct appeal in favor of a successive writ. And the twin limiting principles, properly understood, provide the court the necessary tools as a matter of legitimate judicial economy to prevent cases from coming before the court on successive writ that are not appropriate, cases where jurisdictional challenges are simply not made. We have expanded habeas corpus, and properly so, to reach non-jurisdictional errors, constitutional challenge, and that's appropriate. But it's also appropriate then for the court to deploy its tools to channel those cases into direct appeal. But it is anathema to principles of ordered liberty and rule of law that a man or woman would be incarcerated on the process that he colorably argued was both illegal and unconstitutional, and to suggest that we can relegate him to the direct appeal process rather than, or disentitle him to the successive writ based on some practical facts of the case, we believe would be inadvisable. If the court has no other questions.
Let me see if I can. Is everybody who is on bail or pretrial release or post-trial release eligible for a writ of habeas corpus?
Well, if you're asking Justice Prosser whether they're eligible for a successive writ, we would say no, because the alternative remedy doctrine that was articulated in Dow and a bindover decision that Justice Babich decided, those are the sorts of cases where there are remedial trial mechanisms. They also presuppose that there's an existing ongoing action in which you have remedy. You file your motion challenging the bindover decision. If you don't like it, you take it up on appeal, and that's appropriate because you've got an adjudication. Those things happen internal to an existing adjudication. So no, the post-conviction habeas corpus, the pretrial challenge to a bindover, they might be available. But if that petitioner does not like the decision he gets from the court that hears that habeas corpus, he or she can't go up on a successive writ, not based on the doctrines of this court. They are relegated, and properly so, to the direct appeal process. I believe it's a very, very rare case where a petitioner can make colorable allegations of jurisdictional incompetence. I believe this is such a case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Assistant Corporation Counsel Matthew McVeigh of Racine, representing William McReynolds, Sheriff.
Thank you. May it please the court. Again, my name is Matt McVeigh. I'm an assistant corporation counsel with Racine County, and I represent Sheriff William McReynolds in this matter as the respondent. I do not represent the city of Racine, and I do not the sheriff doesn't take a real position as to the underlying merits of whether a municipal court can or cannot issue municipal commitments. But we are here to address the procedural issues as we view them, and those are two. One was Haas in custody when he filed this second writ so as to allow him to do so. And second, given the fact that Haas had filed an original writ of habeas corpus in the trial court, did he even have the ability to file this second writ of habeas corpus on the same exact issues, given the fact that he could have appealed that first writ of habeas corpus to the Court of Appeals in the event that he did not like the decision of the trial court. As far as whether or not Haas is in custody, he wasn't in custody. He was not in physical control of the sheriff when he filed his second writ of habeas corpus. As the court has pointed out in the petitioner's argument, he was under order of a court that would have been a June Judge Torhorse order, which denied his first writ of habeas corpus and remanded him back to the jail. Now, that order was stayed, and it was stayed for a period of 45 days to allow Haas to pursue his appeal and to allow Haas to ask the Court of Appeals to further stay the matter. Now, Haas had that remedy available to him, and it's interesting to note that he never did that. He filed his appeal, but he never took advantage of asking the Court of Appeals to further stay the order.
What are the contours of constructive custody?
Well, if you look at the Wolfhard case, which the petitioner brought up, the issue or the language is restrained of his liberty. So in the Wolfhard case, we have a criminal matter where there's a recognizance bond. And the restraints that court noted were there's appearance whenever required by the court. That's one of the contours. He had the submission to all court orders and processes. You were subject to bail liability. You had to give the clerk written notice of any telephone or address change within 48 hours. And I think the biggest thing is if you fail to appear after being out on bond in a criminal matter, you're subject to rearrest, and a separate charge, a felony charge, I believe, can be issued for an escape. So that separate offense was also at, I believe those were outlined contours. And in our case, I don't see those matching up.
Well, what about a person who's on probation? They're restrained of their liberty, aren't they, constructively?
Yes, they are restrained in certain respects. You have to do what the probation officer tells you, and you're subject to a hold. So in that case, there are specific restraints.
I mean, it certainly matches up with some of the elements that you just recited in the Wolfhard case, but not all. So that's why I'm exploring what does it mean to be in constructive custody. We know that it means something other than actually being in jail with behind bars.
That is true. Again, it's restraints of liberty. It's the state doing something to restrain your liberty. And our position is that in this case, all we had was a stay of the order, a complete stay. So there were no other restraints on Haas at the time he filed the second writ. So I think on the spectrum of things, while there was a court order that could be reinstated, there were no absolutely zero conditions because it was completely stayed. So that would be on one. To hold that constructive custody in that aspect would be, I guess, a liberal extension of the law.
What would happen if he went to Washington State, just moved there, given the status of this proceeding? There's a stay of execution. Does the county have any recourse?
Well,
not that I'm suggesting this, but I'm just wondering, because that goes to the issue of whether or not he can be required to come back to this jurisdiction for purposes of confinement. And if he can, then it seems that applies with regard to the argument that he could be charged for escape if he were on some restraint with regard to recognizance bond or probation being charged with violation of probation. So if he went to the state of Washington, does Racine County just wash its hands, fold up its tent, and go on to the next case?
Well, Racine County would, because Racine County is only the sheriff in this matter. But the city of Racine, who has an interest in seeing that their ordinances are obeyed and commitments are validly thing, I think, would have to, I'm not sure exactly what the city would do, to be honest with you, as I sit right here. I think they could ask that a contempt be issued, or somehow he's contemptuously violating the order, secure the contempt, and then seek to have that contempt recognized in Washington State somehow.
So there is some kind of restraint of his liberty, You just can't move any place he wants for any period, pretend like this is behind him.
Yeah, I believe the city would have some type of recourse. I cannot outline exactly what it was, but I think they would have some type of recourse to see that the order is fulfilled if they chose to take it to that extent. So I would agree that there would be some kind.
Is that, I'm trying to visualize the constructive part of the constructive street. That, just as Brad hit on a good point, although I think how did it, the restraint, he can travel where he wants. The question is whether or not the city will do anything. And I don't know, when you say, how can you call that constructive? That means that they would, in the normal course of business, probably want to put this matter to an end. It either sits there for years and then it's dismissed for failing to act, or eventually they're going to do something with these ordinance violations. But the question that I have is just how does that fall into constructively restraining Mr. Haas? Huh?
Well, I think given the city would have to do some act, and that act hasn't been done in this case. At the time, Haas, without having that act being done, I guess is once removed from our, from custody in a sense.
I'm concerned about just what the issues are in this case. You have set forth two. In your view, are these issues of a great moment to the sheriff and need to be resolved?
In terms of the sheriff, I don't think these issues are of great. Sheriff's role in this was to produce the body to the circuit court. Whether the circuit court upheld the commitments or said they were without jurisdiction, sheriff obeys court orders. Insofar as what information we did provide the trial court on the merits of the issue, from my review, and I'm not the city attorney, it seems that the city filed a well-established statutory process by which the city issues out commitments when their orders to obey the ordinance are disobeyed. And we produced the affidavit of the city clerk, Michelle Belair, I believe her name was, and that outlines the process that the city took. And in that municipal court procedure, it's in chapter 800.095, entitled Non-Payment of Judgment or Non-Compliance with Work Order Further Proceedings. There's all sorts of opportunities for somebody under those orders to come in to the city, to the municipal court, and contest either the ability to pay or some error or that type of thing. So our opinion would be that it seems to us, under our review, that it's more of a routine municipal court procedure.
Here it seems to me that the sheriff here is not really directly concerned as to whether habeas corpus lies and whether successive habeas corpuses are permitted.
Well, the sheriff, I guess, does take an issue as to whether successive habeas corpuses can be filed. In that, we think we take the position that that may open the floodgates to file successive writs of habeas corpus on identical issues.
Which you then would have to respond.
Exactly. So that would, we would take an interest in that.
And as to the underlying substantive issue relating to the municipal, the authority of the municipal court, you take no position and you're the wrong party here.
Correct. That is correct. In fact, when Haas asked the trial court to stay the original order denying his writ of habeas corpus, while we were the party responding, we took no position.
Justice Bradley.
I have no additional questions. Thank you, Chair. Well, let me follow up with a question, and that is this. Let me give that hypothetical, $76,000, 5 years in jail. And the current procedural posture of this case, there's a stay of the execution. It appears that there is no bond attending that. How is it then, if that's the facts, how is it that Mr. Haas can challenge this right to bring a successive writ of habeas corpus? What does he have to do? Does he have to go to jail and be in custody in order to fight it? Do you understand my question?
Yes, I do. I do understand the question. And I think in this case, Haas's opportunity was to ask the Court of Appeals to take the appeal and ask the Court of Appeals to further stay the order. If the Court of Appeals chooses not to further stay the order, then I believe Haas, under the order of Torhorse after the 45 days, would be remanded back to the jail. And at that point, he would be in custody, but he still would not have the opportunity to file a second successive writ of habeas corpus in our position, because the adequate remedy that he has at that point, having received a decision on his first writ of habeas corpus, is to go through the Court of Appeals. Now, the only points that Haas brings up how that remedy is not adequate is it's somehow slow. But we take the position that it's not slow or any slower than a second writ of habeas corpus. Immediate relief would be available to him, like we said, if he sought to stay the matter in the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals thought it was of importance to do so at their discretion. And if you look at the standard of review in this case, I believe this court has held that under habeas corpus law, when you appeal a decision, that it's mixed law and fact. And Haas isn't contesting any of the facts, he's contesting the law. So that appeal would be the same review as a second writ.
He did nothing to contest, as I can see it in circuit. That didn't even... that was not raised. Now, whether your opposing counsel indicated, well, he was pro se, and although he was represented by someone other than, but he was, let's say, in a pro se capacity, it's still what's before this court is simply the question of a successive writs, and certainly nothing dealing with the city of Racine, because they're not here. So we couldn't decide that if we wanted to, because there isn't anything, as I asked before, there isn't anything here before us on that, and I don't think it can reach down and do anything. So this constructive restraint, still, I want to come back to that, and as in any case where, if I understand it, Mr. Haas is out, there is no bond, he's at liberty, and we would have to basically speculate, wouldn't we, on what's going to happen. That's what we're doing. We're saying we think that's what the city might do.
That's right.
I mean, because it doesn't, and that's why I was troubled when you look at Wolfhard or you look at Fuentes or some of these other cases, that we're really, and I gather from Justice Bradley's question, she's giving a hypothetical what if, but that is where we're at. It's what if, or could this happen? As I see it, he could move any place he wanted, and it would be the same as though where he could stay and receive. There still is a what if the city would do.
That is correct. There is a what if, and I imagine if he moved out of the city of Racine, the city would be less concerned about enforcing the city. But
maybe it would be helpful, counsel, if we went and started at the beginning to outline what the applicable processes and procedures are had this gone the ordinary course. Citation issues from the city for failure to abate lead on the property, failure to remove snow and ice from the property, failure to register a vehicle, right?
Right.
Okay. What happens when a citation issues? You get a court, you need to pay the citation just right off the bat, right? Or you get a court date and you come to court to contest the citation, right?
Correct.
Okay, so that's where you contest the merits of what the city is claiming you did or didn't do in violation of the city ordinances, right?
Correct.
Okay, and at that juncture, there's also an option to put the whole matter into circuit court by demanding a jury trial, isn't that right?
Yes.
Okay, so Mr. Haas could have, if he had reason to contest the merits of the citation, he could have shown up in municipal court, demanded a jury trial, put the whole matter into circuit court, and he wouldn't even have the jurisdiction of the municipal court at issue, right?
Correct.
Okay. He didn't do that.
Correct.
He defaulted.
Yes.
He ignored it. He didn't show up.
Right.
So the case is called, the municipal court judge finds him in default and assesses the applicable forfeiture, right?
Correct.
What are his options at that particular juncture? And at that particular juncture in the process, the forfeiture is assessed against him, and typically the municipal judge assesses a jail alternative for non-payment of the forfeiture. Isn't that how it works?
I believe so. I believe if you don't show up and there's a default entered, the city still has to take an extra step at that point.
Okay, so there's even one more layer of protection. So
yes.
let's take it at that point. The forfeiture is assessed, and then there's a timetable established for payment of the forfeiture, right?
Right.
Okay. And then what happens at that point?
If it's default, if there's no payment, then the municipal court has to issue another process under this 800-095, which basically is an order to show cause for an opportunity for Haas, in this case, to come back into court, explain to the court why he's defaulted, perhaps why he has no ability to pay these forfeitures in that. And if you ignore that process...
Okay, so at that point, even before the commitment for non-payment, the contempt commitment for non-payment and the jail alternative gets assessed, he gets a notice, and it's in order to show cause to come before the municipal court why you should not be held responsible for this forfeiture or pay the consequences of a jail alternative. So he could have come to court at that point and contested the court's, the municipal court's jurisdiction to issue a jail alternative, right?
Correct.
And he could have at that point put the whole matter into circuit court?
I believe so, yes.
Okay. And he didn't do that. He ignored that.
Correct.
Okay. So the commitment issues, right?
Yes.
And that's in the nature of an arrest warrant, really. It commands the constable or the sheriff or the police officer to bring the defendant in, basically, to serve the commitment or pay the fine.
Correct.
Okay. He ignores that.
Yes, he does.
Right. And he gets arrested.
Yes.
On the commitment. A habeas petition in the circuit court.
Yes, he does.
Circuit court lets him out, grants the writ.
Yes.
Provisionally. Orders briefing, orders a hearing, come to court, tell me all your reasons why you think you shouldn't have to serve this commitment.
Yes.
All right. Everybody comes to court, there's briefing, he gets a full plenary hearing on his jurisdictional issue, on the argument that the municipal court doesn't have the jurisdiction to issue a commitment like this.
Absolutely, yes.
Okay. Trial court says, no, I reject those arguments. The municipal court was acting within its jurisdiction. You go back to jail or pay the forfeitures.
Correct.
Okay. What are his options at that point?
Well, he can ask the trial court to stay the order, which he did.
He did that, and he got a 45-day stay to prosecute a direct appeal.
And then his option is to take a direct appeal of that decision.
And he did take a direct appeal, but he voluntarily withdrew it.
Correct.
Because he wanted to put the matter in a successive writ posture in front of this court.
Correct.
But he has already had at least two opportunities in the municipal court.
Correct.
Right. Both of which carried an opportunity to litigate the merits of both the underlying citations and the jurisdictional power of the municipal court to issue the commitment in front of the circuit court.
Correct.
Okay, and then he's had another opportunity by way of his circuit court habeas.
Yes.
And he invoked that, and he loses. And then he has another opportunity in the Court of Appeals to make his jurisdictional arguments. And he initially takes advantage of that opportunity, avails himself of that remedy, voluntarily withdraws it.
That's correct.
So he's had multiple opportunities to raise the jurisdictional argument, so it has hardly evaded review, except by his own actions.
Right. It's only evaded review because he voluntarily dismissed the appeal, which is his remedy for a disagreement or about the trial court's decision after having a full day in court on the exact issues that he's trying to raise in the second writ of habeas corpus currently at issue.
And he had he pursued his direct appeal of the denial of the ultimate habeas relief in the trial court, and had he lost there, he could have brought a petition for review with us, right, and get the further review of the legal jurisdictional issue that he wants to raise here, but still has neglected even to raise here in this successive habeas writ.
Yes, that is true, and that's the way it works. That's absolutely true, and I think that's why we argue, and the sheriff takes an interest in saying that the remedy isn't to file a successive writ, have a new trial, and go with the common law way of doing things, because the common law allows you to file as many writs as you wanted, but the reason for that was because of that no one considered writ of habeas corpus a final judgment upon which you can take appeal. Now that's changed. And he can take an appeal. And so given that he can take an appeal, that was his remedy to a decision he may have disagreed with by the circuit court.
Counsel, in traditional common law, I don't mean that. I mean habeas corpus has been interpreted traditionally to go to the court's jurisdiction. Is that correct?
Yes.
Say in municipal court, and so in other words, if you want to attack an order of the court because the court didn't have jurisdiction to issue it, not because the court was wrong, you know, that's through appeal, but didn't have jurisdiction to issue it. Let's say this case involved a defendant who committed a burglary, and that's a felony. And of course, municipal courts don't have authority to handle felons. They don't have jurisdiction to handle a case. And this is going to be a real hypothetical, because I just can't believe this would ever happen. And let's say they went to municipal court, and the municipal court judge said, okay, 10 years in prison, 10 years in jail. Municipal court doesn't have jurisdiction to do that. Just can't do it. Not that they're wrong, they can't do it. And then the defendant takes a writ of habeas corpus to the circuit court and says, hey, circuit court, the municipal court doesn't have jurisdiction to do this. And the circuit court denies the writ and stays the execution. Can that defendant, who has been sentenced to 10 years in jail on a felony charge in municipal court, ask, bring a writ of habeas corpus again, saying, hey, you can't send me to 10 years in jail on a felony charge in municipal court, can he?
Our argument is no. He doesn't have that option. His option is to appeal it, and if it's in a grievous situation, he can say, hey, Court of Appeals, take my appeal and stay it before hearing it, so I don't have to suffer any of these 10 years which the court never...
No, I look over here. You know, this is 1215. That deals with King John and all the great writs. And the writ of habeas corpus has been with us for a long time, and it traditionally has attacked the issue of whether the court even has competence to do what it can do. Not whether it did it right or wrong, whether it has competence. Why should we now take that writ that's been around for a long, long time and say, oh no, this great writ, everyone knows about the writ of habeas corpus. They may not know about all these other fancy writs that we have, but habeas corpus they know. And we're going to say that great writ now can only be exercised through appellate procedures as though there were court error, as opposed to the court is incompetent to begin with, doesn't have jurisdiction, can't even rule on what it ruled on, let alone rule wrong. And that's what you're asking us to do, isn't it?
In part, but in part not, because in this case, Haas already had a day in court about the writ of habeas corpus. I'm not arguing that his sole remedy was to appeal through a writ of error or the appeals process the municipal court's decision. And that's versus having an ability to file a first writ of habeas corpus. And in that, if we're arguing about that, that would be a more interesting question, I think, actually. But the question is, having filed that first writ, does Haas have the ability to file a second successive writ on the same exact issues? So the choice isn't between not being able to file a writ or filing a writ, but the choice is whether or not he can file a second identical writ, having filed the first one in circuit court. And given that choice, I don't think it's less of a concern as far as the degradation of the great writ. That type of argument. The common law allowed it to be filed successively, but the reason, again, for that was because you couldn't take appeal from it. Once appeal became available, then jurisdictions began to limit one's ability to file a successive writ. That's the law that was cited in the Derner case in 1901, the Heller case, and a case we cite in our brief is a U.S. Supreme Court case, McCleskey, in 1991, recognized that that's the rule in the state of Wisconsin. Now, that wasn't the exact issue before the Supreme Court, but they at least saw it that way. And I guess it makes sense from a couple arguments. Number one, you have a respect for final judgments. So the person who comes to court gets their day in court, and that's the decision, and they can appeal it. And number two, your alternative to allowing these multiple successive writs is a floodgate situation. It allows forum shopping. If we apply
if the successive writs were only to deal with jurisdiction, not error, correct, but jurisdiction, competence of the court to proceed, what floodgate is there on that?
Well, I guess that's a narrower. Not as many people, I guess, have an issue of jurisdiction versus constitutional problems that often come under writ of habeas corpus.
How many municipal commitments are out there, do you think?
Excuse me, I didn't.
How many municipal commitments are out there for alternative jail sentences for non-payment of fines or forfeitures?
Oh, I think there's
thousands, right?
Thousands, yes.
Counsel, in this case, although what was issued wasn't an order and warrant for commitment, it was a contempt finding, wasn't it? Contempt of court commitment upon sentence.
That's the way it's styled,
yeah.
As a contempt of court. It certainly
says
that.
Page 1 is on page 119, 120, 118, etc. It says contempt of court.
But it says, and contempt of court commitment upon sentence. If you look at the affidavit of Michelle Belair, I think it steps through the process the city took. And the process wasn't a contempt process as much as it was the commitment process outlined in 800.095 that Justice Sykes stepped us through.
But there was, although it's denominated contempt of court, this wasn't a contempt of court, is that what you're saying?
Right, it was a municipal commitment. And it wasn't a, I don't know don't know if they use the same form. That form maybe should be changed. I don't know.
But would the municipal court have jurisdiction, that is, competence, to issue this contempt of court, as we see on pages 118 and 120?
Yes, it does. If you look at, it's following chapter 800.095, the procedure laid out in the statutes to allow commitments.
And doesn't 800.12.2 say max is 7 days?
And that, I think 800.12.2 is the contempt portion, allows a municipal judge to issue a contempt order. And if this was a contempt, yes. That.
If this were a contempt, these orders would be, the orders that said 11 days would be in violation of the statute.
Correct. But since it's a commitment under 800.095 sub 4, and I'm looking at A1, it talks about the maximum fines, and it says, and maximum period of imprisonment is 90 days for offense. So that allows it greater than 7 there. I can see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McVeigh. Mr. Bernhoff, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
We have several points on rebuttal. First, with respect to the idea that a contempt commitment really isn't a contempt commitment, we find that to be implausible. On its face, the commitment is very clear. It says contempt, commitment upon sentence. It is absolutely controlled by the contempt statutes, 812, and the related statutes. There's also a significant issue here. In order for a municipal court judge to find someone in contempt in a summary proceeding, the defendant or the contemnor, the alleged contemnor, must be in the actual presence of the court. Haas was never even in the actual presence of the court, and those contempt commitments, we urge, are a void, ab initio, as a matter of law. Back to the issue of constructive custody, which the court has expressed some concern about. The United States Supreme Court in Payton v. Roe, a case that's oft-cited in all of the state jurisprudence, indicates that even the threat of imminent arrest is constructive custody within the scope of the writ. And additionally, Haas was subject to additional process of the Racine County Trial Court. And I think the point is well taken that the city of Racine would absolutely pursue its remedy to bring Haas back before its jurisdiction by whatever means that were available to it. And I'm not an extradition expert. A significant point needs to be made about the statute that's been referred to as the commitment process, 800.095 sub 4. First, it's very clear that that's a contempt commitment, and it was issued or should have been issued under the controlling statutes that govern contempt. It's either contempt or it isn't contempt. And we would point out that it's axiomatic at law that a court, the legislature, and the executive are prohibited from doing indirectly that which they're prohibited from doing directly. We find it telling that in the trial court proceeding, Judge Michelson was invited to submit a brief into the court. And there, he conceded in that brief that he could not directly force the payment of the forfeitures, and that's why he issued the contempts. A classic situation of a non-court of record doing indirectly that which it is prohibited from doing directly. Now, we never found out from Judge Michelson why he thought he could not directly commit Haas for failure to pay forfeiture. We urge that it runs afoul of the constitutional prohibition against imprisonment for debt. But turning to 800.095, the statute that's been cited by opposing counsel as the authority under which this commitment process was issued, I advert to the legislative history and notes in a brief quotation. It comes from 1991 Act 40, Section 23 provides, and I quote, initial applicability. This act first applies to persons who, on the effective date of this section, violate ordinances that prohibit conduct that is the same as or similar to conduct prohibited by statute punishable by fine or imprisonment or both. So the underpinning authority for Section 800.095 is criminal conduct or ordinances that punish criminal conduct where there's a statutory counterpart that is the same or substantially similar to statutes that provide for punishment, a fine or imprisonment, or both. The municipal court cannot reach to 800.095 and imprison Haas for failure to pay forfeiture based on the statute's plain language and the historical legislative intent. That commitment, if it was issued under any authority at all, that authority, it says what it is, res ipsa loquitur, the thing speaks for itself. It's a contempt commitment. Haas was not arrested under 800.095. He was arrested and put in jail for contempt. We would point back to the constructive custody rule and this choice that Haas has put through, and Justice Sykes' comments are well taken about all these various opportunities that Haas may or may not have had to address the merits. But at base, this isn't a question about whether it's a normatively good thing for someone to cause snow to be shoveled in a timely fashion, lead, etc. It's about how we regulate, who regulates, how we enforce regulations, and who enforces them. And at base, the municipal court, based on our argument, cannot imprison people for failure to pay forfeiture. Now, we would also point out, as a matter of policy, that the municipal corporation can pursue all of its legitimate interests without running afoul of the imprisonment for debt provision. For an example, Section 799, the small claims procedure. The municipal court is able to move in a small claims procedure in a court of record and obtain a judgment. And the Attorney General has opined on several occasions that the municipal court achieving such a judgment has all the full panoply of creditor remedies available to it to enforce that judgment. Supplemental proceedings, execution, levy, garnishment. So the legislature has provided remedial mechanisms for the municipal court to achieve these conceitedly salutary objects of public policy, health, safety, and welfare, etc. The municipal court simply does not have to violate the Constitution to achieve its process goals and its ends. Unless the court has further questions, we would urge that the court reverse and remand to the appellate court.
Justice Brasser.
Could you state very succinctly what actual remedy you want if you prevail today?
Yes. First, we respectfully ask the court to direct the appellate court to issue a writ of habeas corpus and conduct a habeas corpus proceeding. Alternatively, because at this point, and I was not counsel of record in all of these proceedings up until the petition for review, several weeks after the petition for review was filed, in terms of advocacy for my client, a merits review, and I think public policy is served well by a merits review as well. So putting the doctrine of successive writ to one side, the essential fact that we need to achieve here, the process, is an adjudication on the merits. And if the court could fashion a supervisory order directing the appellate court to reinstitute the appeal for a merits briefing, we would be absolutely pleased with that outcome.
Counsel, has your client asked for that? He voluntarily dismissed the appeal. Has he in any way asked the appellate court to do that, to reinstate the appeal?
No, it wouldn't be his prerogative to ask the appellate court to reinstitute an appeal. I think an order like that would have to come from this court under its supervisory jurisdiction. But I've had consultations with my client, and I've prevailed upon him, and we are in agreement that a merits review is what's really required here. And so, although the doctrine of successive writ, from a professional standpoint, as an officer of the court and as an attorney, I believe the efficacy and availability of the great writ by successive writ under the very narrow class of cases where a petitioner can allege colorably jurisdictional defects is important to the fabric of the law of the state. But directly answering Justice Prosser's query, a merits review would vindicate these underlying allegations or disprove them, and then Haas can conduct himself accordingly.
In the original, in seeking the original writ in the Court of Appeals, was there an effort to litigate the merits of this then?
Well, if the Court of Appeals had, in fact, and again, I was not counsel there, but if the Court of Appeals had, in fact, issued the writ, there would have been a habeas corpus proceeding. and that's what would have happened there. I'm not exactly certain what the procedures are in the appellate court for doing a habeas corpus proceeding. I imagine they might have appointed a special master as a fact finder and maybe ordered briefing and then taken oral argument on the question.
The trial court has already ruled on this, hasn't it?
I'm sorry?
The trial court ruled on the merits already?
Yes. And if I can make
that's the appeal that was not followed.
That's correct.
Okay.
As far as what the trial court did down there, and it's telling that the sheriff and probably, well, the sheriff took a position that he wasn't liable before the trial court for civil liability. And, of course, that question really wasn't before the trial court. The question was the lawfulness of the custody. And the city, oddly enough, didn't, in our opinion, we respectfully assert that the city did not join issue on the specific allegations that first, the citation was not compulsory process, violation of constitutional prohibitions for imprisonment for debt. And I reviewed that material, and I don't see a good joining of the issue, a fair disposition. So although, and we should never confuse this, the habeas corpus proceeding, there was summary. There was no trial. There was briefing. There was oral argument. But I was a bit dismayed by the fact that the county, the city, and the other parties did not more fully join issue on these significant questions. And with the greatest of respect for the trial court, the order was made from the bench. And while if I was counsel, I might have filed a motion for findings of fact and conclusions of law, the bench order was cursory. There wasn't any citation to authority or any reasoning. It was essentially a four-point order. Municipal court had jurisdiction. Due process wasn't violated. And that was the order. So we should not be a...
Yes. Was the city a party here ever?
The city cannot be a party in a habeas like this because it's always the party having custody, generally the sheriff, that is the proper respondent. And there was some dispute about the caption in the trial court. Ultimately, we believe the caption is correct before this court, that Sheriff McReynolds is the proper party. The city was heard. The city filed a submission as a friend of the court based on the trial court's invitation.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Bernhoff, and thank you, Mr. McVeigh, for appearing today on this issue.